KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, independent filmmaker Adam Leon on his award-winning film, Gimme the Loot, shot guerrilla style on the streets of New York. Plus, what's really on the menu at a show business power lunch. But first, the Hollywood news banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, a recent court ruling has the number two man at News Corp, Chase Carey, threatening that the Fox Channel, which is the home of American Idol and New Girl and The Simpsons, could be turned from a broadcast network, which you can get with your antenna at your house, into a cable-only channel. And this court ruling has Univision equally upset and making a similar threat. So why don't you explain what these people are so bent out of shape about?
They're upset about a startup company called Aereo, which has close ties to Barry Diller, who ironically started the Fox network. Aereo is a New York-only company that has basically a central antenna. And the antenna is composed of tiny little antennas. So imagine 1,000 antennas the size of a dime kind of stuck together. And from that little antenna, Aereo captures over-the-air broadcast signals, and without paying the broadcasters any money, then puts those signals through the internet to its subscribers, which pay about $8 a month for the privilege of watching these signals on their internet connection.
So in this day and age, John, you know, in the old days, TV networks sold ads and they split up the money with the studios and everybody hopefully made money. Nowadays, the audiences have fragmented, the world has changed, programming is still expensive, so they have two streams of income. They have the advertising and they have what they call retransmission fees, which are fees paid by the cable companies or your satellite provider. And then when you sit down at your house and you turn on your cable box and you watch something on CBS or ABC or one of the broadcast networks, you are paying indirectly because those cable channel people are carrying that signal. That cuts all these people out of the process. You would just be basically sort of spiriting these signals down, and you could be watching on your iPad somewhere, or you could be watching in your house on your computer, but you aren't paying the cable provider. The only people you're paying are the Aereo people.
Yeah, and the broadcast networks really believe that this is copyright infringement. And the real issue is the courts are divided. The ruling that you allude to is a ruling that was issued early in April by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York. And they issued a 2-1 opinion saying Aereo did not violate the copyright. But I think the really interesting point was made in the dissent. And the dissent kind of echoed an opinion that a trial court judge found in California, and I'm quoting from the dissent now, and that judge says, in my view, by transmitting or retransmitting copyrighted programming to the public without authorization, Aereo is engaging in copyright infringement. So you have these courts now that are divided on the issue, and I think the next step is the networks are going to appeal to maybe the entire Second Circuit. Maybe they'll try to get certification before the Supreme Court. But this legal dispute, even though it's very small right now, involving just a handful of subscribers in New York, I think threatens to become a very big issue in television.
In China, John, there was a brief, very brief, little window where you could watch about, I don't know, couple of minutes of Django Unchained in the theaters after a big buildup. And Sony Pictures thought they had a deal to distribute this film in China. Second biggest market in the world right now for movies, and things went wrong.
It was just a couple minutes into the screenings of Django Unchained in China where the lights came up, the projector stopped, and it appears as if, although with everything in China, you never really know what's going on, that China's State Administration for Radio, Film, and Television, which is basically the censorship group, decided that, yeah, maybe they'd approved it initially, but they're changing their mind, and so they basically pulled Django out of theaters. So I think the next question is, will people in China still find it? Because goodness knows there's lots of pirated DVDs on the streets of China.
And what's odd is, you know, Quentin Tarantino, the director and the filmmaker, had made changes in Django Unchained. He had changed things like the color of blood. I'm not sure how that makes it different, but apparently they darkened the blood. They changed the blood spatter. So they'd been through a process. And then it turned out that, maybe because there's some nudity in the film, something pushed the buttons of someone in China. And this kind of illustrates the hazards of doing business in a country like China, where it becomes very hard for a studio to just kind of make some overall deal and think the terms are set and everything is going to be smooth sailing.
Yeah, and the problem with China, too, is there's no appeal process. It's not like you can call up the studio or the exhibitor saying, but here's why people should see this movie. I mean, what China says is what goes in China. And so Sony, the distributor of the film, and Quentin Tarantino really have no recourse here.
Speaking of legal recourse, I think a lot of people were interested in this actress that had sued IMDb, claiming that they had published her actual age and thereby hurt her because Hollywood is rather age conscious. She had a trial. It didn't seem, based on the reports that I read, that the case went particularly well from her point of view in court, and that was confirmed when very quickly she lost.
The complaint that she made against IMDb is that the company had taken her birth date from her credit card information. And her basic argument was that by publishing her birth date, even if it was true, she was going to be discriminated against in Hollywood based on being of a certain age, meaning it started with a 4.
Yeah, and I think the sympathy that a lot of people had for her was, A, they do feel there's age discrimination in Hollywood, but B, it is also enormously confounding to try to get IMDb to change information, and we've heard these accounts from several people. If it is inaccurate, it is just like a Kafkaesque nightmare to try to get them to say, oh, yes, let us fix that. And I think she somewhat managed to illustrate that, but there were all sorts of confusion about how she communicated with them and whether she had told them the truth about various things. And it just became a hopeless situation, I guess, for her, and a very quick loss for her. And I think some people kind of be disappointed.
Yeah, and sadly, I don't think this is the end of people lying about their age in Hollywood.
Why would they do that? Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn in the Los Angeles Times. And you can follow us on Twitter. My handle is @KimMasters. John Horn is @JGHorn. Coming up later in the show, the Hollywood Power Lunch isn't about the food.
Geography is more important. Proximity to power is more important. Efficiency of service is more important.
But first, first-time filmmaker Adam Leon makes a tiny movie that gets a big response. Gimme the Loot is a sweet but gritty, very low-budget movie that was shot in 70 locations across New York City. It follows two teenaged African-American graffiti artists from the Bronx as they roam through New York, desperately trying to raise the $500 that they need to bribe their way into Shea Stadium. The idea is to put their mark on the big red apple that pops up when the Mets hit a home run.
So look, this is what you're going to do. You're going to call Pedro. He's going to sneak us in. We're going to bomb that stupid apple. Then when they get a home run, everybody going to see our names on it, right? And who's going to be on our dick? Them Queens.
Yo, you crazy.
No, I'm serious. No. That's guy.
Yo, that's brilliant. That's brilliant.
31-year-old filmmaker Adam Leon is a white guy who grew up in Greenwich Village and majored in African-American studies at the University of Pennsylvania. But he says the inspiration for making a film about African-American teens in New York came not from his college studies, but from his experiences in a public high school, a magnet school that attracted kids of very diverse backgrounds from across the city. Though Leon didn't pursue film courses in college, after he graduated, he worked as a production assistant for Woody Allen, and closer to home, he had another influence. His stepmother is Leslie Dart, one of the industry's most formidable publicists. Her clients include Martin Scorsese and Meryl Streep. I asked Leon about her influence on him and his career.
Yeah, I mean, Leslie is definitely a force in the entertainment industry, I think, and that's fair to say.
Fair to say, yes. I've been at the end of that force, so I say yes, absolutely.
I've witnessed that, not with you in particular.
Right.
And she's been helpful. There's no doubt about that. But, I mean, again, in terms of this movie itself, I think that her help has come in more after the fact, because it is such a small movie that we really just took to the streets and made. This isn't a studio movie.
So how did you go about making this film? It's a very low budget film, and it's shot, I assume, without permits all over the city of New York.
Basically, what we did was we took out other producers that we know that had done this, and we said to them, we're not trying to ask for your financier list. We're not trying to get you to do work on this movie. We just want to buy you a drink and talk to you. And we were able to convince some people to give us their business plans and to give us some advice. And we built a business plan, and then we went out and tried to raise the money. Ultimately, we got really lucky. Somebody that I did not know through the film world, I did not know through Leslie, came on board and I think really liked what we were doing and helped us out.
Somebody, anonymous person with money, somebody?
Yeah, this is a guy I knew through my girlfriend, who's a Spanish teacher, and and her college roommate's husband, you know, is a businessman. And I think he's a friend of mine, and I they're very, very good friends of mine, obviously. And I didn't go to him and ask him to invest. And I think that they saw how hard we were working and how difficult it is to chase down these leads where, oh, there's this really rich kid and he wants to be in a movie and he'll fund your movie if you give him a one scene role, and you sort of chase him around the country and he never returns your calls and all that stuff. And I think that my friend saw that and saw how serious we were about this, and that while we were first timers, we were professional in the way that we were going about this, and said, I want to be a part of this. I believe in you guys, and came on and gave about half of the funds.
You actually have to chase around a rich kid and say you can be in the movie if you give us money, and then he doesn't return your calls. That sounds so terrible.
It is terrible. I mean, but again, nobody knows who we are. We couldn't get a meeting. I mean, that's the thing. You might think that because my stepmother is a publicist that I can get meetings with financiers, but no. I mean, there's nothing to go on. Nobody is going to say, like, I love your work. And this story about African-American teenagers who curse a lot and do graffiti and run around New York and nobody's ever heard of them either is, you know, it's gold. There's nothing sexy about it. At first, we went to the Cannes Film Festival. We won at South by Southwest. It became sexy. You know, it became this sort of great journey. But nobody believes that that's going to happen, except if it's somebody who really, I think, knows you and believes in you. And so we were able to do that a little bit here, a little bit there. This one angel investor came on and very much helped, but we pieced it together from Kickstarter. I had saved up some money from working at this film center. Another person that was a real mentor of mine that I had worked with at the Film Society of Lincoln Center came on and gave a little bit of money. And, you know, it ended up really working out, but I think it took people who said, these kids are hungry for this. These kids have been actually working for it for a very long time, even though they're relatively young. And they're serious. They're going to go out there and they're going to do it.
So you had to go out there and really pitch your brains out, which I think I always imagine for somebody who's got an artistic nature is probably very difficult to do, you know, to sort of sell.
I don't ever want to do it again. I mean, but you have to. It is the only, I think the job is so amazing. It's the greatest job in the world. I love doing this so much. It's the only part of the job that really stinks. But you got to do it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Adam Leon, whose first feature film is Gimme the Loot. He started out paying for the movie by hitting up friends and family. Once he got the cameras rolling, he turned to the crowdfunding site Kickstarter. You may recall that Kickstarter made news recently when producer Rob Thomas and actress Kristen Bell turned to the site to raise money for a movie based on Veronica Mars, a TV show that played for 3 seasons on the UPN and the CW a few years back. Thomas and Bell met their goal of raising $2 million in less than 11 hours, and by now they've raised more than $5 million. Leon's goal was a lot more modest, to raise $22,500.
We're not Veronica Mars. Nobody's clamoring for the Adam Leon movie.
Yet.
Of course. Much, much clamor.
Right.
No, not now. I mean, it's still been a great ride, but it's like, and so nobody was asking us to do this. So we're not going to really get strangers. You hear these sort of miracle stories of that happening. And I think we did get maybe a couple strangers or a couple people that were very tangential come in and give a little bit of money. But ultimately, we knew that this was going to be a friends and family situation. And so we had already made the movie and it had already gotten into South by Southwest when we went to Kickstarter. We needed finishing funds. And so we could say to everybody, look, we made the movie. Here are some clips. This thing actually exists. But also, the entire budget for the movie is about $165,000. I mean, we got through production, including pre-production, for about $85,000.
So how much did Kickstarter ultimately kick in?
I think it's something like $24,000, and then they take a little bit of a fee.
So that's money. That's money when you're making a film that costs as little as your film.
Absolutely. It was a massive help. And the Kickstarter team was very helpful. They're a really great group over there. But I think they put our project up as like a project of the day for one day.
Do you have to do something to get that, or you just get lucky and you're the project of the day?
I think you just get lucky. I think you talk to them. I think you ask, you sort of, I think you can ask to meet with them or you can have questions for them. I don't know that much. I've been to their offices a bunch, I mean, a few times, and they just seem like really good people who they're like cool and their heart's in the right place and they want to make these things work. And we had a big fundraiser around Kickstarter, which I thought was a good idea. So we had a big party in the middle of our Kickstarter campaign, and we had people come in, and they could come and they could drink and they could hang out and listen to music. And then we had this bank of computers set up with Kickstarter open for them to donate that night. And it really helped generate money towards the movie. And I think that there were some technical issues and they were incredibly supportive, like right like that night. We're freaking out because like Kickstarter's not working, and they fixed it. And they just, my experience, which wasn't super, super hands-on as much as my producer, but from right. what I know she was saying, it seemed like they were extremely supportive and there for us. And they want you to hit your goal.
Now, you mentioned Veronica Mars, and there's been a lot of controversy around that use of Kickstarter. People, some independent filmmakers have said, you know, this is not what Kickstarter is meant to be.
Really?
You're surprised? For a branded thing where there are, you know, there's a Hollywood studio involved.
Who says that?
People.
Who's saying? I don't believe that. I think this is a planted question.
No, it's not. It really is.
I can't imagine that's true. That's ridiculous.
Well, the feeling is that, you know, if Warner Brothers wants to have a Veronica Mars movie, they certainly can afford to put whatever $1 or $2 million to make it, and to suck money through Kickstarter to a studio film is potentially depriving someone like you.
No, that's absurd.
Well, you're very definitive about that.
Yes, that's absolutely ridiculous. And that's like obsessing about when you're a high school senior, obsessing about somebody else getting into your college. It's just like, what are you talking about? You got to do you. Like, that's crazy.
That's not a finite resource.
Yeah, and also, it's like I said, if you're making an independent movie, you're trying to raise $20,000 or $80,000 or $5,000 or whatever you're trying to raise, you know, it has nothing to do with Veronica Mars fans. Veronica Mars fans aren't going to give you any money. It's just a different animal. You're not going to tap into that. So that's a wasted bit of energy. You don't have time for that. When you make one of these movies, you have to focus myopically on the task at hand. Every day, what can we do to make this movie, and what can we do to make this movie better? And those, I think, are the two questions that need to be asked every single day. And at the end of the day, did you move that along? And worrying about Veronica Mars does not help you answer those questions. And that's all that you have to do, is answer your own questions.
Now you are going in theatrical and on demand at the same time. Is that right?
Yes, we are out in theaters currently and sort of expanding all around the country. And then we are also currently available on your cable provider.
I don't even know if you thought you would get theatrical release when you were making the film. You didn't.
No, we did not. We did not know that any of this was going to happen. And we were talking about four-walling it or serializing it on a public access show, doing sort of as many creative – we were trying to think of some creative and clever ideas on how to get it out there in the world. But no, we did not expect this. That was the hope. I mean, that's been literally my dream since I was a little kid, to have a movie come out in movie theaters. So very, very cool. It's cool to sort of sneak into the movie and watch from the back real audiences.
Adam Leon is the writer-director of Give Me the Loot. It's playing now in select theaters around the country, and it's available on demand. Thank you for coming
in. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Coming up after a short break, the serious business of the Hollywood Power Lunch. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
Hi, this is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. If you like this show, you'll probably also like other KCRW programs, such as Good Food, Bookworm, The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell, and Unfictional. You'll find them all in the podcast section of iTunes and on your KCRW smartphone app.
The Hollywood Lunch is a ritual that's been parodied on HBO's Entourage and in films like Barry Sonnenfeld's Get Shorty and Christopher Guest's The Big Picture.
I don't know you. I don't know your work. But I think that you are a very, very talented young man, and I'm never wrong about these things. Excuse me.
Keith. Mm.
Yes?
Could I have another Cointreau and Sody? Mm-hmm. And could you send an almond tort over to the gentleman in the white suit in the corner?
Nonetheless, the Hollywood Power Lunch is serious business on a lot of levels. Deals are done, of course, but some in the industry also expend a fair amount of energy analyzing the subtext of who's eating with whom and where. Journalist Gary Baum researched the current state of the Power Lunch for The Hollywood Reporter and shared his findings with Evan Kleiman, host of the KCRW show Good Food.
So let's talk about, I guess, defining the Power Lunch. What is it exactly?
It's Hollywood's business meal, where they come together and how they develop relationships, how they close deals, and how they get to know each other and how they sometimes come to hate each other.
Do you think that more business and more important relationships are actually forged over the Power Lunch than in actual meetings?
I think it depends. It depends on how social people are. One of the things that we found in our reporting is that the Power Lunch isn't what it once was. Digital media has really changed things. The constant email rapport, texting, video chat, those things have really changed the nature of the business. People don't lunch the way they used to. People would lunch because they hadn't seen each other. They needed to get to know each other. They needed to maintain their relationships, develop relationships. It was a key thing. Now it's different. Now people meet to get to know each other in the first place or to close a deal. It's developed a different allure, a different texture than it once did because it's not quite as crucial when you're constantly in digital contact with each other.
That's kind of sad in a way. It sort of reduces the big power players to the same kind of business life as the rest of us.
It does. It does. And I think that when we spoke to a lot of folks, they felt nostalgic for the days gone by when there was an excuse to be out of the office for 3 hours in the middle of the day, and it was and there was a reason to do that, and it was relationship building. It was this amorphous need to come together and do what people at the very top of the food chain do, and that is stroke each other's egos and circle each other and decide how they were going to influence each other and therefore influence the town.
Now, when we talk about a power lunch, are the two players, well, let's just assume it's two people. Are the two players sitting at the table at the same level, or is there a pecking order as to who invites whom?
There are power lunches of equals, and then there are power lunches where one person is a bigger deal than the other, and that totally affects the way that things go. Who pays and who doesn't pay? Who drives further and who doesn't? Who's going to be sitting out towards the restaurant and who's going to be facing the wall? All of these things are unwritten but known. It's all these sort of codified rules of the lunch.
So if you are the one, if you find yourself being the one that has driven further, is facing the wall, and pays, you definitely are second banana.
Not necessarily if you're paying. Paying in Hollywood is something of a form of bowing. You're paying if you're inviting. You're paying if you want something. You're paying if you need something. Sometimes you're paying because you have the bigger expense account or you have the bigger salary and it's clear. But oftentimes you're paying because you're in the subservient position. The $20 million movie star never pays. Their agent always picks up the check.
Now, you said these are unwritten rules. What happens if some poor sap somehow is not aware of the minefield of all of these unstated rules? Can you cut your own level of power by making a misstep at a power lunch?
I think that you can reveal yourself to be an amateur. So much of Hollywood is based off of ideas of savviness, knowingness, information, and all of the gestures of the lunch are based off of saying, I know what's going on.
Let's talk about the place. Now, I understand that craft is considered to be just crucial to the folks at CAA.
It was. It was considered unofficially its commissary.
What is a commissary?
A commissary at studios is essentially the cafeteria. And so for CAA, the agency, Kraft opened essentially, it shares a courtyard with its offices in Century City. And it's Tom Colicchio's restaurant here in Los Angeles, the from Top Chef. However, not too long ago, he defected from CAA and went to the rival WME. CAA retaliated by taking their business elsewhere. WME has picked up the slack by really supporting its client and making sure it brings its expense accounts there. CAA has gone to another favorite, Bouchon, in increasing numbers.
Bouchon being Thomas Keller's restaurant.
Correct, in Beverly Hills. Both of the agencies are now driving further for their lunch.
Okay, so we're at this lunch. Does there have to be certain characteristics to the room of a restaurant in which power lunch happens?
People prefer enough space between each other so that they can have privacy. They prefer booths. They want an idea of privacy, physical privacy, but they also want to see each other. There's a certain panopticon quality to these restaurants.
Meaning that it's important for there to be sight lines throughout the room.
They want to see each other and they want to be seen. It's common after a big box office weekend for people to take a victory lap or after a big promotion or if people want to be seen meeting with certain clients or prospective collaborators. The idea of poaching, it senses ideas of trouble in the water. It's all there if one knows to look.
So it reminds me of like film representations of the old days at Sardi's, where after a meal or maybe between cocktails and the table, people will go around the room and press the flesh, patting people on the back, whispering into ears.
It's exactly like that. Food is fuel at these lunches. It's much like a date. You definitely don't want to order what your heart desires. You order what is easy to eat, what is quick, what is efficient.
What about drinking? Are you allowed to have a glass of wine or a cocktail?
No. Alcohol is done. There's no more martinis. Iced tea is the new martini.
What do these lunches cost, more or less?
It depends. There are restaurants where lunch for two can go for $50. There are places where it can go for $125 to $150. I don't think that cost is as much of an issue. It's not really the main criterion. Geography is more important. Proximity to power is more important. Efficiency of service is more important. Those are more important than the food itself and the cost.
What about lateness? What happens if you're late to a power lunch? Do you want to be early, or is that equally as bad as being late?
There's nothing wrong with being early, but you don't want to be more than 10 minutes late.
So we've mentioned two restaurants that are venues for power lunches. What others?
Soho House, the private club at the intersection of West Hollywood and Beverly Hills, is our number one. The Polo Lounge, which is the oldest restaurant on the list, is also our number two. Some of the other top restaurants include Ibaldi, the Grill on the Alley, and Ammo, which is a restaurant over in Hollywood and is popular because of its unique location. It's at the sort of nexus between Valley players, people at Warner Brothers and Universal and Disney and DreamWorks and folks on the West Side. It's a great meeting spot in the middle.
Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed being here. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Special thanks to Jillian Ferguson. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on SoundCloud, iTunes, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.